Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Gareth Greenaway joins me. We're going to be doing episode 500 of Floss Weekly, and we'll be talking about contributing to open source. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Gareth Greenaway. Episode 500, recorded October 3rd, 2018, contributing to open source. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and totally unaware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show. Well, if this was a project-oriented show, that would probably be apropos, but it's not quite, and we'll get into that in a minute. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Gareth Greenaway. Gareth, welcome back after your long absence.
Thanks, Randall. Glad to be back.
Yeah. And where are you speaking to us from? That Thousand Oaks bunker still?
Back? Yeah, my underground Thousand Oaks bunker, once again.
With the sun still shining through the windows, even though it's underground.
Right.
That's amazing technology. You've got some amazing technology there. And I am once again at ZipRecruiter, my longtime primary client, gives me the most money each year. And I am in yet another, as we may have, those of you watching the video may have seen that this is now the fourth beach named conference room that I've been in. This is Zuma Beach behind me. So if you look in the video, that's a nice big picture of Zuma Beach. And I really appreciate being here because, well, first off, they pay me. That's an important thing, but not right now, but they pay me most of the time. But also because I get gigabit bandwidth. So I have a Cat 6 going into the wall, and I'm actually pegging speed tests. So we're not going to have many dropouts today. This is going to be one of the best shows ever because of that. Also, Gareth, do you know what show number this is?
I've heard a rumor that it's quite a monumental show number.
This is show number 500. Do you think we ever could have gotten to 500 without me just being persistent, maybe a bit of a bit of a juggernaut occasionally? But I tell you, we've been doing this for 11 years, we collectively. And it's just been great. I'm going to keep doing this as long as Leo keeps letting me do it. So maybe we'll hit show 1000 eventually, but no, this is great. This is great that we're at show number 500. And also, rather coincidentally, even though this wasn't planned until, I didn't realize this until a few months or a couple of months ago, is that we have an amazing guest on today. We have Vicky Brasseur. I've seen her at multiple conferences give very wonderful talks. She seems to get the gist of what open source is about and how to contribute to open source. And we're actually going to be talking about her upcoming book, currently in development, called Forge Your Future with Open Source. And I've seen a few snippets of it. It looks like it's going to be a really great book. I'm really looking forward to that. We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about open source in general. We'll be talking about contributing to open source. For those of you that have been waiting for a generic show where we're not actually just talking about a specific project, this is your show. This is a show you guys all keep asking me for. So we'll talk about licenses. We'll talk about how to build communities, all sorts of wonderful stuff. Gareth, you have anything to contribute to after that?
No, I was just going to also say I've known Vicky for a couple years, and I'm really excited to see what her book, the contents of her book. I'm looking forward to reading it. I think it's a very timely time. I just made that phrase up, but it's a very appropriate time for something like this book to come out, given the state of a lot of open source, free and open source communities. A lot of them are struggling with just all a myriad of issues. And so I think a book like this is very, its release is very timely.
Yeah, and also to add to that, I think that the problem is that we're suffering from our own success. It's like back in the early days, you really had to pay attention to anybody coming along new that might contribute, and you pampered them. You made sure they understood where the bug tracker was and how to make a pull request. Before there were pull requests, back in the early days, you know, you had to do all this stuff because there wasn't just a huge number of people that could possibly contribute. So you had to pay a lot of attention to that. And I think we've kind of lost some of that. And so we'll get into that in the main part of the conversation. But before we do that, I do have an important message. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's talk about buying a home for a minute. Because of rising interest rates, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a home these days. It's causing a lot of anxiety with folks. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Step one, answer a few simple questions and they'll check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval, which gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if the rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/floss, rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Let's go ahead and bring Vicki on. Vicki, welcome to the show.
Well, hi there, folks. Oh, my God, 500. Cheers. Good on you, mate.
Cool.
That's just incredible.
Normally we start with what's the 30,000 foot view? When would you reach for this project? But we're not really talking about a project today, so I'm sort of a little out of my water. So why don't you talk about a little of your background and what you've been able to observe over the years? And that's probably the whole show right there. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh God. So background, I used to run software engineering departments at the VP director level. But I gave up my big corporate job and now do freelancing for companies to help them sustainably use, contribute to, release, and comply with free and open source software projects. So that's my day job, is I actually make money from open source, which is less rare than it used to be, but still I feel incredibly privileged to be able to do that. I have been in the industry for about 20 years and using free and open source software for approximately 30 or so.
Yeah, it's actually pretty similar to my background, and yes, I've actually Perl has been very, very good to me over the years. So it's I can actually say yes, I've had my day living off of basically creating open source software for other people, working for companies that need enhancements to the open source code that they have, working for people that are building a closed source infrastructure, but based on open source stuff. So, and sometimes they get to contribute back out. Like I know here at ZipRecruiter, there's been a number of contributions to the CPAN directly from people who have developed it on their day job here. So this is they're really trying to do that. So, what's changed the most in open source over those 20 years? Over those 30 years, actually, I guess.
Well, it's. Back in the day, you would say open source to someone and they would have no idea what you were talking about. Free software, if you say that, they would assume you meant I don't have to pay for it. It's free. Mm-hmm. We all know that's obviously not the case. And we also now are in this situation where you don't have to explain it quite as much anymore. Open source software has become kind of this the default for so many things. If you're going to develop something, you're going to start with an open source base. Right. You might then keep it internally and keep it proprietary, but you're going to start with open source. You're going to start with an open source programming language, open source libraries, open source operating system, most likely. So it's just become the way that we do business.
And it's also interesting because it's sort of shifted in the business models now. Pretty almost, well, I'm biased because I've got blinders on. I'm only in the open source companies related stuff. But it used to be that a company would have an idea for like a project, even like a web project or something like that, or maybe a proprietary software on desktop or something. And they'd go out and they'd purchase or license closed source libraries and then build on top of that and produce their own closed source ultimate widget, ultimate thing. And now I think I like the way you said it. I think it's now more the default that you're going to start with open source. You're going to start with, you know, if you want a website, you're going to start with Apache or Nginx or something. You're not going to buy, you know, stuff from somebody else to do that. And I really like that transition is happening. And I also like the transition that's been happening over the years that people are going all in on open source. Instead of saying we're going to have a proprietary product, as we've seen on this show over the last 11 years, many, many companies are saying we're all open source top to bottom. We put everything out there. We develop our work in GitHub. We take pull requests. It's not just the list of the internal company people that are contributors. Look at all these other contributors that are outside the company. Can you talk more about that sort of transition as well?
Well, there are some companies that do that, but there aren't really nearly as many as you would think. There are a lot of companies who would like to be more open, but they just don't know how. And I think a lot of that is our fault in free and open source software. A lot of the culture of free and open source has been very much, you know, screw the man. We don't want these big companies in our free and open source software. And so we have kind of pushed companies to the outer limits of the community. And because of that, they aren't comfortable. They don't know how to interact within a free and open source software culture, within that sort of ecosystem. And a lot of them also don't know how to make money out of it. So that's a completely separate issue that free and open source software has nothing to do with. So it's something that I think we have done a disservice to ourselves in free and open source software by not embracing these companies, not showing them how to do it properly over all these years. But on the other hand, it means that I have a job. Because that's what I help companies do. I understand business really, really well, and I understand free and open source software really, really well. And so I'm able to be that glue to help the businesses be successful with free and open source software. And not just to be successful, but to understand what it is and to do it right in a way that's good not only for their bottom line, but also for the community, because that's very important. You can't be participating in free and open source software as a company if you're not going to get something good out of it. But you also can't participate if you're going to screw up the community, because that's not going to be good for anyone. So how do you do both of these things? Well, you get me in there and I help translate.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that's it's been interesting, and I think actually this show has highlighted it on a number of times, is it's difficult initially, if you don't get what open source is actually leveraging, to understand that by publishing your entire source code, you no longer have just the resources that you can pay a salary to. You also have the resources of anybody that's interested in that software as well. And until a manager, whoever controls the pocketbook, understands this principle of leveraging, it's a no deal. I mean, it's like, why would I give away all my intellectual secrets to the public? I need to, and that's the way they think of it. But what you need to think of it is as how to leverage. But that also requires being dedicated to developing community. In other words, keeping your bug list public, keeping the commits you're making actually live on GitHub rather than having a separate repository that you refresh once every quarter, that kind of thing. And I've seen companies do that and fail because of that to build a community. Can you say more about that as well?
It's one of those situations where you see a lot of companies just sort of throw something over the wall, right? We're going to release this thing, perhaps because we're not using it anymore, and so we don't value it, and so we just want to get it out there and think we're being helpful by just giving it to the community. But if you're not there to help support the community and build the community, then it doesn't matter. Now, you're not going to get people contributing. You're not going to get that sort of amplification that you do from new contributors if you're not there paying attention to the community, making sure it's welcoming, Having a code of conduct, enforcing your code of conduct, making sure everything is documented, and really supporting those new contributors. Otherwise, they're not going to get those pull requests, that sort of free, I guess, that free work that you would otherwise get from free software. And that's something that a lot of companies actually make a mistake with. They assume, well, if we release this, then look, we don't have to pay just our developers to do it, because now we can get all of this free coding from people out in the world. And that's not what it's about. It's not about getting free development. It's about building community and helping to become that rising tide that floats all boats. So you can't be entirely selfish about contributing to the project or releasing the project. You do have to think about the greater good. And so if you are releasing something, you have to pay attention to that, because if you release it, they will not necessarily come. If you make it a welcoming and a community and a good place to be, then yeah, people will be there and they will contribute and they will use it more, and it will become this beneficial cycle where you get more users, more contributors, more users, more contributors.
So one of the things that a lot of companies seem to struggle with when they decide to make their kind of core product open source, to go down that path, is, okay, all of our code is out there now. How do we continue to make money? And we've seen a lot of companies make various attempts. We've seen like OpenCore, we've seen services, we've seen support, that kind of thing. Can you speak a bit about kind of what your experience and maybe some advice for companies that are looking to open source their core products, how they can continue making money, like what you've seen work and what you've seen that hasn't worked?
What I've seen that hasn't worked is people releasing their secret sauce without figuring out a business model first. And a lot of this is due to, I think, very poor advice from VCs, who do get this sort of, if you release it, they will come situation, which is, they push a lot of open core, which is great. But if you don't have that business model, if you haven't figured out yet how you're going to make money, then for crying out loud, don't release your code yet. Figure that out first. That has nothing to do with free and open source software. That has everything to do with learning how to run a damn business. Just get that nailed, figure that out, and then your free and open source software becomes the tool that you use to help make a profitable business. It is not the reason to go into business to release free and open source software. You're not going to necessarily make money just on that. You have to learn how to run a business, which means you have to do user studies and market research and, you know, make sure that there actually is a market for this product that you're trying to do. And what is your product? Are you going to be selling support? Why would people buy support when they can just use the product, right? You have to figure that out before you go releasing your secret sauce. Just don't do that. That's very poor business. I don't care if some big highfalutin VC with a very snappy suit and a nice car tells you this is the way to do it, because that's not necessarily the way to do it. That's not how you run a business, open source or otherwise.
So one of the things, I have my own personal opinions on this, but I'm going to suspend those for the moment. As far as like a lot of, like I said, a lot of organizations, a lot of companies decide to go the open core route. Do you think, and have you seen it work, or does it usually end up in a situation where the open source product or the open source project is competing with the closed source open core version of that project?
It depends. There are companies who are being more successful with it. Hortonworks does a pretty good job with Hadoop. They're quite successful. I think they might be a unicorn at this point, but they're quite successful. MongoDB does a decent job. Of course, there's always going to be Red Hat. Nearly, I think they're coming up on a $3 billion company now. They're certainly over two, but they're very large, and they are open by default in just about everything they do. So it is possible to be successful with this. But what you find more often are companies that haven't figured out that business model yet. And then they're not quite as successful. their business model might frankly be, let's get acquired. That's going to be our exit. We're just going to become acquired. And if that's your business model, great. But often for open core companies, that seems to be the way that a lot of them are taking out. Rather than building a successful, profitable company, they are just sort of looking for that exit so they can appease their VC. I have no problem with VC, by the way. I'm all for you getting the funding you need to get your work done and develop a good product and, you know, serve your market. I'm all for that. But you got to know how to run a business if you're going to do that. And a lot of people, they have a hot tech stack and they assume that's all I need for a business, and it's not.
As someone whose day job is actually to write open source software for an open source project, I can reaffirm that comment that we actually do like getting paid. It's a nice thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I like to keep my cats in the manner to which they've become accustomed.
So one of the things that I've noticed over the years as companies form around open source projects, inevitably, the company that forms grows, and more people are being hired, marketing, sales, just general people that you see, general positions that you see as a company grows. And inevitably, you're going to get people that did not grow up with the open source, the free and open source mentality as part of their growing up phase. And so they do not have an understanding of the reason why the company exists is because of the free and open source project that's behind it. What advice would you have for kind of educating those people and just making sure that they have an understanding of why having the kind of core product open source is a good thing?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about because I've seen this myself. And scaling is great. I love that when companies are successful enough that they're able to hire all of these new roles like marketing and finance and customer support. But if the fundamental foundation of the company's culture is free and open source software, then as a company, you have the responsibility to teach people about that. You can't assume they're just going to pick it up. So this should become not only part of onboarding and a very large part of onboarding, but it should be reinforced for everyone across the entire organization, equally for everyone. Make sure everyone understands not only why it's important to the company and, you know, don't just do some hand wavy thing. Figure out why free and open source software is important for this company. But also what free and open source software is. And that's one of the things I found with a lot of new contributors is they hear about open source and, oh, I'm going to contribute to open source, but they don't know the history. They don't know about licensing. They know licensing is a thing, but they don't know about it. And so giving people that kind of foundation of knowledge on which they can then build, because otherwise you'll just give them the reason of, oh, our company loves free and open source software. It's very important for us for this specific reason. But it's just sort of hanging there, right? You have to have a foundation for that to stand on. And then people will not just be able to regurgitate your little mission statement back to you, but they'll understand it and they'll be able to internalize it. And that will help to maintain that sort of that culture of open source and free software across the entire organization in a way that people really truly understand it. They don't just say they understand it.
It's a fair answer. So one of the questions that out of the chat room, IRC channel, kind of somewhat related to what we're talking about, but a little bit random. So on your sweatshirt, it says that you are a yak shaving expert. So yes. Jay Bennett was curious if you could explain what a yak shaving expert is.
Oh, I don't know whether this is trolling and he doesn't know or not. I don't know whether Jay is a male or female or NB.
It's Jonathan Bennett. It's one of our co-hosts.
Okay. Hi, Jonathan.
So we know him.
So yak shaving. I have to get a better kind of elevator pitch for yak shaving. So let's say you really need to fix a chair in your dining room. But to fix a chair in your dining room, first you have to clear off the workbench. But before you can clear off the workbench, you have to empty out the garage because there's no space for the shit that's on your workbench. So before you empty out the garage, you have to get rid of the yak that's sitting in your driveway. But before you can get rid of the yak that's sitting in your driveway, you have to shave it because that's why it's there. You have to shave the yak, and it's sitting in your driveway. So that's kind of the thing. Yak shaving is all of the crap you need to do before you can actually get back to the one thing you're trying to accomplish. And we do this all the time in software development, right? We are constantly having to, oh, well, I need to make this one little change to the UI, but in order to do that, I need to upgrade to this new framework, which then allows me – means I have to update to that, to this, to that. No crap. Next thing you know, I have to update all of Python to update to Python 3 so I can get these libraries. And yeah, yak shaving.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my main server that runs Stonehenge.com to be up to the latest release of FreeBSD because I'm lagging slightly. And it's like, okay, but in order to do that, I've got to update the packages that go with it. And I've got to like, maybe I want to just move it to another host so I have both an old and new version to make sure I don't break something in the process, because that's my livelihood there, to be able to you to send mail to Merlin at Stonehenge.com. So it's like I've got to change that while we're on the fly, and it's just been this long list of things I have to do ahead of that to really make that happen. So I totally relate to you, actually. It seems like about half of what I do these days. Let's talk about your book. So that's part of the reason we were having this conversation originally, is that you have a book coming out called, get it right here, Forge Your Future with Open Source. What is that about? What is it like? Where are you in the process? And who is it for?
So I'll start with where I am in the process because, oh my God, it's so exciting. It went to the printer. It's being printed like today or tomorrow. It will be in hard copy in a couple of days and then start shipping out. But you can get the EPUB DRM free. I believe also they have a Mobi. Anyway, you can get it from Pragmatic Press now. You can get the completely ready version in ebook. So that's available. Yay. Yeah. Who it's for? It's for everyone who wants to contribute to free and open source software. It's while it is written such that it's very useful for developers, it specifically goes out of its way to make sure it's inclusive of all of the roles necessary for free and open source software development. So designers and translators and security folks and documentarians and just all of the folks who are necessary to make free and open source software project or any software project successful. Because that's something I think we really need a lot more of in free and open source software. We've got developers, obviously we need more, but we need to do a better job of these other roles in the development process. And that I think is going to help to raise the quality of free and open source software. We haven't made these people feel as successful yet. As to what it's about, I'm kind of going backwards, popping the stack here. It is about how to contribute to free and open source software. It's kind of the, not to violate somebody's copyright, but it's the unwritten manual, the missing manual for how to contribute to free and open source. Everything from how to interact with a mailing list to how to find a project that's good for you. That is probably the most common question I get from new contributors. How do I find a project? Well, I should just contribute to Linux. No, you probably shouldn't just contribute to Linux. There are millions and millions of projects out there. We're going to find one that's right for you. And so how do you do that? And that's a lot more complicated. If you want to be successful, you should probably put some thought into it. There are sections in here about how to contribute to projects. If you don't know how to code, there's an entire chapter just about how to make a difference without making a pull request. Even if you do know how to code and you're just tired, but you still want to contribute, what can you do? So there's just all sorts of great stuff in here. It is approximately 200 pages long, I think, a relatively quick read according to my, I must have had 20 some technical reviewers on the book, and they all seemed to think it was okay. So the book. I'm very excited. I've never written a book before. I know you, you Randall, have written a book and multiple books, I think. So yes. It's an exhausting process. Holy crap.
It's like, okay, say goodbye to your nights and weekends for about a year. So I remember that very, very well, which is why I don't write any more books. Now I'm just, I'm happy if I could just do a screencast and put it up on my Dart and Flutter channel. That's about as close as I can get to actually publishing anything these days. Two things about that. One, I see you're going to be at All Things Open. Will you have a printed copy in your hand before that?
Yes, it actually kind of drove the entire process. My editor, who is an amazing human being, I love working with Pragmatic, but my editor, Brian McDonald, is just spectacular. He's been in the industry for like 20 years, and he's so good at what he does. And he put up with a lot of my shit. Sorry, Brian. But he wanted to have a book signing at All Things Open, so we kind of went backwards from there. When do we have to have all the work done so we can have printed copies by All Things Open? And that made things a little tense for a few weeks as I very quickly pounded out three final chapters. But it's done. We will have a book signing. I believe there will be about 30 or so books. So if you will be at All Things Open, I would love to see you there. And I will pretend I'm not at all wigged out by the fact that I'm doing a book signing. It would be my first one. It's a little weird.
The first one is really weird. I remember having 200 people lined up for Larry and I to sign the first camel. And we were astounded that many people would show up. It was really, really, really wonderful. You'll remember this as a special day that your life pivots, you know, 5 or 10 degrees off of how it's been going so far, just because it's such an amazing experience to have that. So good. Yeah. Make sure you set aside one copy for me in case I don't have to be right at the book signing. I'm going to be scouting for more Floss Weekly guests as well. So I'm going to actually have a talk I'm giving. I'm actually a speaker this year. Yay. Speaker.
Okay. Yay. I was just going to ask whether you're going to be there. So you're going to be there. Definitely. I'm going to be there. Gareth, yes. You're going to be there.
I will unfortunately not be at All Things Open this year.
Oh, drat. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's our loss entirely. But Randall and I will be there, and we will say very nice things about you behind your back.
Oh, absolutely. Of course we do. Of course we do. Also, the other thing, obviously one of your readers, your early readers, Grim One, I don't know what that maps into. It says, the book is great, by the way. I read an earlier beta version and can't recommend it enough, even for seasoned open source contributors. So pretty strong recommendation from one of the people in our chat room.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Grim One. I don't know who you are, but that's the sort of stuff that really makes this worthwhile. I couldn't have gone through this without constantly reminding myself that this is going to help people. This is going to help open source. This is going to help projects. Because we do have a problem of scale right now. If you look at the state of the Octaverse study that GitHub puts out every year, there are millions of new repositories on GitHub alone every year. And yeah, those are new public repositories. So they might not have a license, so they're not open source for that. They might be forks of something that somebody just wanted to do a pull request. Okay, that is open source, but it's not new. Let's assume like maybe a quarter of those are brand new free and open source software projects. Who's going to maintain all of that, right? We need to start doing a better job of training people and giving them the guidance they need so they can just jump in and start making a difference, because otherwise we're going to collapse under the weight of our own success.
Yeah, and one of the things I've said, actually, I did a keynote at Fizzlay about 4 or 5 years ago about contributing to open source, and a lot of people have the mistaken impression that, oh, I don't know how to code, so I obviously can't help. Mm-hmm. But there's coding. There's even filing a bug helps, filing a feature request, writing some documentation, translation, writing up tutorials, posting a screencast on it. There's all sorts of ways people can help. Did I leave anything out?
Oh, there's probably I like triaging bugs myself for new things that people have reported. Can I duplicate this? That's really valuable for new for somebody who let's say you're a maintainer. I just want to fix the bug. I need to fix that bug and get out, but I don't have the time necessarily to go trying to duplicate it and getting all those steps. So having somebody else look at those and say, yeah, okay, this is a bug, that's not a bug, or have you upgraded to the latest version because we think it's fixed there? Having someone else deal with the issue queue is so valuable. And it saves so much time for the people who do have the moments where they can like start hacking on some code, right? Just getting them some air cover can be really helpful.
And one of the things that I've actually done for other projects before that requires almost no time on my part, except when something goes wrong, is I've been a smoke tester for various projects. So in fact, for example, I still to this day compile Emacs daily, and I compile Git daily, because I was the canary in the coal mine for the Git project to make sure that they didn't introduce Linuxisms, because I was compiling this on my OS X laptop. Oh, excuse me, Mac OS now, I've got a name for that. And also on my originally OpenBSD, but now FreeBSD boxes. And so I would download it every day, test it out. And if something broke, I could say, hey, you've got a Linuxism in here. If you want this to be on something besides Linux, you're going to have to fix this. And it was appreciated by the projects. I mean, it was a welcome thing to happen. I even asked Linus originally, I said, am I irritating people by doing this? He goes, no. We really want Git to be universal. So you're doing a very, very good job there. So so that's something that people can do. It's just smoke test these things, right?
Well, and another thing you can test is the documentation. Do these install docs, are they actually useful for somebody who's never picked up this project before? Can you actually successfully set up a developer environment with this documentation? And what would be super useful, holy crap, please, Windows users, help us with our docs. Help us help you. If you are a Windows user and you want to contribute to free and open source software, we often aren't running the right platform for this, and we need help writing documentation that's approachable for people who are using other operating systems, who are using, say, BSDs, because we tend to assume that everybody is developing on some sort of Linux thing in the cloud or OS X, sorry, Mac OS or my Mac.
Whatever it's right called there. This week, yes.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So we make these assumptions, and it really helps to block out and exclude a lot of people who could otherwise contribute.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to address that a little bit further, is that, so let's say I decide I want to help with the documentation for a project. Most projects have a very difficult barrier to entry for that, because it's not listed on the, you know, their pages, their community pages, things like that. It's not set. Who do you talk to if you want to contribute to documentation? There's not even an email address or a web form to fill out. There's plenty of problems like that, right?
There's tons of problems like that. And the problems are different for every single project. It's not like there's one way to contribute to free and open source software. Every project is going to do it differently. Even projects that all are on GitHub, you would assume, oh, we're all on GitHub, we're using the same process, but they're not, right? Some of them have tests, some of them have gatings, some of them have, you know, completely different ways to approach things. Some folks want to everything in issues, other people want to talk about stuff on the mailing list only. So there is no one way to do it, which is great, and really helps to enable a lot of the diversity of free and open source software. But it's also very difficult as a new contributor. So read the contributing guide. If there is any contributing guide at all, read it. If there isn't a contributing guide, find another project, because your time is valuable. If you've never done this before, just don't do your first contribution on hard mode. Right, you want to be successful at this. So find something that's easier to contribute to, a project that has gone out of its way to document, here's how we do our workflow, here's how we do our issues, here's our formatting for documentation, here's a style guide, for crying out loud. Because if you are running a project and you don't have a style guide, it kind of implies you don't care how people are contributing or what their code or their documentation looks like, but I guarantee you have opinions. For instance, if you're contributing to one of my projects and you're not using the Oxford comma, I'm going to fix it. you know, we all have opinions. So just admit it and put that in a style guide, however minimal, the things that are really going to get under your skin. But it's hard to tell that. If you haven't written a contributor guide, if a new contributor shows up, they're going to bug you. They're going to try and find you on IRC or Slack if you go that way, or your mailing list, and they're going to bug you. And you're going to get the same questions over and over again. So for crying out loud, just document this stuff, right? I love docs. Docs are a force multiplier of humanity. Just write it down, please.
Good plan. Good plan. And also, it's like speaking of different ways to contribute and how different it can be between projects. The Git project is one of the weirdest ones, I think. Now I'm going to get hate mail from all the Git people that are working on that. But it turns out that the way to submit a patch to Git is you drop the patch as a series of mail messages on the general mailing list, which is the only mailing list, which I unsubscribed to years ago because it's too voluminous. It's got beginners there. It's got the experts there. They're all in one big pile. And all the patches that are being requested to change things. It's just, I don't know. I'm not running the Git project, so I'm not going to change that. But, man, it's just it's crazy. But you have to learn these things. You have to. Each project, as you said, is absolutely different about how they want to deal with stuff. Some people don't want pull requests. Some people just want you to file a bug and figure out, you know, how to make things work. And it's really contributing to open source is a little tricky. And that's not even counting. I don't want to get into this too deep because we don't have a lot of time left, but there's also the idea, though, that because there aren't codes of conduct for all things, or people aren't complying with them, there's also a poisoning that's happening out there. And it's sad because then it's like, even if I did want to contribute to a project, if I get a nasty taste the first time I try to submit a bug request submit a bug report. That's what I was trying to get to. They let anybody do the show apparently for 500 episodes. So you want to submit a bug report and they didn't like the format it was in, or they didn't like the tone of it, and then they yell at you, and it's like, well, I'm not going to help that project anymore. And people don't understand how damaging this can be to the community overall. Is that a fair assessment?
That's beyond fair. And it's not every project, right? There are some projects that are really open and welcoming and helpful and patient. Those are also probably the ones with the best documentation because they have an empathy for the people who are trying to contribute and they want to make it easier for them, but also take care of themselves by reducing the number of hits they get from people asking them the same question over and over again, right? That can be very irritating. And then that can make you snap at people when you don't want to or you don't otherwise mean to. But yeah, this is a huge project in free and open, or project, huge problem with free and open source software projects. Is that we don't welcome people very well. We have this sort of, I did it the hard way and so should you, or it's okay if I'm a real asshole to you because it's all about the quality of the code. It's not about the quality of the people, which is just going to drive away the good people. And therefore you have this diminishing sort of level of civility within a community. And then that turns into a reputation for a community. And because of that, people will stop showing up and they will talk in the back channels and say, hey, I'm not going to participate in this community because look at what they did. Why would I give my time, my free time? And time is the most valuable thing we have because once you spend it, that's it. It's gone. You never get any more. So why would I spend the most valuable thing I have on a community and a project that's going to treat me like shit? Why would I do that? Of course, people aren't going to show up to your project if you're real about it. So codes of conduct are very important. But even more important is enforcing that code of conduct and learning how to do that properly. It doesn't just come instantly. You don't just figure out how to do this. You have to take the time to learn how to welcome people, how to deal with negative situations when they come up, and how to deal with it in an empathetic way. Because often the people who are being don't know they're being, right? They just think this is the way you do things here. So you have to explain to them what they did was wrong, but also why it was wrong. Because otherwise they'll continue making the same mistake over and over again. You have to assume ignorance rather than malice until the point where you have figured out that it's malice, and then you have to figure out how to get rid of that person or otherwise make their interactions safe within the community. It's very complicated. There are people who specialize in this. I am not that person, even though I'm good at it, but I don't specialize in code of conduct stuff. So,
as you were describing those situations just now, I was nodding my head in agreement. There's always been a kind of a unwritten rule that getting involved with an open source project, and it's been that way for years, and it's getting better. But there's always been a unwritten rule that in order to even use it, and even just as a user, not as a contributor, or not as someone who's contributing to the project, but it's almost like it should be a trial by fire, that if you do not fail at least once in attempting to use it, then something's wrong. It should be difficult to get involved. And there's a lot of us who do not believe that's true. A lot of us believe that, like, no, it should be, if you want someone to use your project, it should be as easy as possible to get started. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, we have kind of set up this gating system in free and open source software, right? You have to be good enough. You must be this high to ride this ride, sort of thing, where, you know, this bar seems to change depending upon who's talking to you and to whom they are talking, which is why that whole meritocracy thing is usually, because it never really defines what merit is or how people get there. It's just sort of, I'll know it when I see it. And that is constantly in flux, right? We all have biases. And so I know it when I see it will change if you are biased towards the person at the other end of that. We also have done this really bad job of making our stuff usable, right? We assume that people are going to come to us and they want to use our stuff. And so they will just put up with it because they need it. They need this library. They need that utility, and they will just put up with whatever they have because, oh, well, that's what you've got. And that's not good, because free and open source software started as a kind of this moral mission to help spread the four freedoms. And a lot of people really deeply believe in Stallman's four freedoms of software, but then they do things like make it difficult for people to use or contribute to their projects. And you're not going to spread the four freedoms if you're making shit hard. You're just not. What you have to do is meet people where they are. And that's actually going to be the topic of my keynote at Freenode Live this year is, you know, how can we do that? How can we, as free and open source software people, how can we start shifting the dialogue to start meeting people where they are so we can get more users, more contributors, so we can spread the ethos of free and open source software beyond just our tiny little world of software itself, right? What can we do to increase that and make the entire world better?
Yeah, no, exactly. So one of the things I was thinking about while you and Randall were chatting, and it popped into my head as he was talking about his experience as kind of a smoke tester for the Git project. And one of the things that he would do is like build and test Git on OS X. One of the things that I've noticed over the years, and it's kind of made its way into various like Linux distributions as well. If you're using a particular OS, you're seen as not a supporter or not you don't value open source software. We see that a lot with like if you're a user of OS X or if you're a user of Windows. There's a myth that because those particular operating systems are your choice, you don't believe in open source software, even though there's a plethora of open source software that is available and used on those platforms. So I'm curious, like your experience. I have a feeling of your experience on this because we've talked about this before. But I'm curious, like your experience there, and as well as like advice you have for kind of combating those attitudes.
Well, my personal experience is I get a lot of shit for it. People question my dedication to free and open source software because I am Mac all the way. I use all Apple products. I have the entire suite here. I've got my Apple Watch, my iPad, my iPhone, all my little doodads, right? But I used Linux for 10 years as my primary driver, as everything I did in my life was based on Linux. And what I found is I was spending way too much time working on that and trying to make it kind of beating it into submission so I could get my shit done. And oh my God, that just got so tiring. I don't have time for that. If I want to make free and open source software better, I need to get that out of my way and just sort of streamline my particular workflow. And I do that with Mac. And the thing is, there's room in free and open source software for everyone. And if you go bagging on people because they're not using Linux, because they're not using free software, A, you're a bigoted sorry. But B, you're just pushing people away whom you would otherwise be able to bring into the fold by showing them, oh, have you seen GIMP runs on Mac? Let me show you how to use it. So you can use GIMP rather than Photoshop. Oh, look, Inkscape, totally free software. Let's use that. Or, you know, so helping people to understand that there are free options that could be potentially as good, rather than making them feel like crap for not picking your special, delicate snowflake Linux distribution. It's just, why do we do that? Why are we assholes about this? There's lots of room for free and open source software in free and open source software for everyone, for all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I said, okay, I'm a heavy Emacs user and a heavy Git user. And of course, all of my local code is in Perl. Well, now Dart, of course, because I'm expanding the Dart area. I've been taken to task for running this show. And yet I tell people, yes, we're using Skype. Hey, that's a challenge to you guys. Come up with a nice thing that's better than Skype. Nobody's got one yet. I've tried Jitsi Meet. I've tried Google Hangouts. Nothing compares to the scaling up and down that Skype does when you lose and gain bandwidth and the quality of images they can get in a given bandwidth. There's nothing like it, and I really hate that. I really want there to be an open source equivalent for that. But I'm doing that on a Mac, and I have an iPhone. You know, I bought into the whole Apple infrastructure as well. But I'm running all this open source software in there, and I'm able to run that because the base operating system on macOS is, in fact, an operating system
that is
originally BSD, right? And so I'm happy about that. I'm happy that I'm not that far away. But I'm also happy that every little piece of my hardware, the operating system knows how to talk to. I see so many complaints from people trying to run Linux on an arbitrary, you know, PC that they can't get to we can't get it to sleep. We can't get it to talk to this USB driver. We can't. It's like I don't want to waste
my camera doesn't work or.
I don't want to waste time doing that. I don't want to waste time. I want to have more time available to actually work on open source and contributing to it. So that's the end of the rant on that. I've probably said enough about that already. But I do want to also follow up on something you said earlier about it's okay to make some mistakes when you contribute. One of the things I've been doing recently, because I've been going all in on Dart and Flutter, is that I've been answering questions on the Dart and Flutter channels it's not Slack, it's Gitter, using Gitter. And I've been answering questions, and every once in a while my answer is wrong because I'm still learning myself, but I'm learning by teaching. And so that's really working out nice. And you have to get over the fear that maybe what you'll say is wrong. You know, if you're really, really not sure, you can say, I think it works this way. And then, of course, other people on the channel will jump in and fix that. Same thing, I'm answering questions in Stack Overflow, and occasionally I've been slapped for the wrong answer that I gave. But I'm trying, and it's helping. And it's helping me understand. It's helping me understand the kind of questions people ask so that I can write better tutorials and maybe eventually a book again. It's better to do that. And that's sort of the point you were getting at as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all screw up. We all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. I mean, I've been doing this for years and years and years, and my tech writer still found lots of errors in the book. And that's why tech reviewers, right? Mm-hmm. They found errors in the book, even though I've been doing this for a long time, like stuff I misphrased or stuff I left out. That's why we have communities, so we can help support each other. And it's all about how you do that, right? If you make a mistake, say, oh, crap, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. It should have been this. Please update your mental model or whatever you need to do accordingly, right? Just admit it. It's fine. One of the things I do when I have free time, which isn't right now, but is I study failure. And I have this lovely big talk where I take approximately 3,200 pages of research into failure across all industries and all endeavors of humanity. And I condense it down to 45 minutes. Here's what you need to know about failure. And one of the things that we have is we keep punishing failure rather than using it as the incredible like learning opportunity that it is. I mean, every single scientific experiment comes from failure. You try and then you learn something and then you try again and then you learn something, right? That's what we need to be doing in order to be successful is learning from our failures rather than punishing it. So if you are in a free and open source software community, you know, start to lead by example. And when you make a mistake, admit it and then correct it and say, this was wrong for this reason. Here's what I've done to fix it. And then move on, right? And start to do that for other people as well and support them and say, wow, thank you for coming out with that. Thank you for letting us know that we have updated things appropriately, right? And that's one of the best ways that we have found to create psychologically safe environments. And lots of research has been coming out in the past 5-10 years about how a psychologically safe work environment, be it you know, it doesn't have to be a corporate work environment, it just can be anywhere where people are trying to get shit done. A psychologically safe environment is the most innovative, the most effective, the come in on time as far as their projects, you know, everything. They keep finding all these amazing things about psychologically safe environments and how great it is. But if you are attacking people for being wrong, then you actually make things take longer, you drive people away, which increases your costs because then you have to replace them. And costs aren't only in money, they're also in time and various other things. So, you know, admitting you're wrong and helping everyone show or see that it's okay can do amazing mm-hmm. things for your project and your team.
Mm-hmm. One of my friends says, if you don't actually follow up your failures with a postmortem, don't worry, you'll definitely get to do it the next time you do that.
Yes, you have a good friend. Yes.
I like that phrase. It was a good one. By the way, speaking of your contributors, tech contributors, Grim One identified himself as, where is it? Gary Kremlich. So that's
oh,
him.
Oh, hi, Kremlich. Gary.
Yes, so yeah. Gary's in the chat room watching us as we're live here. We're almost out of time. In fact, we're probably a little over time, but it's just been so great chatting with you. And I could talk with you for another hour at least. I know you've got so many different things to share about this, more specifics about the books and things like that. But is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before I have to let you go?
Oh, gosh. Probably. But I don't remember. Is that one of the questions that you asked me to give you and that I should be prepared to answer? Because I'm not.
No. But it's funny because it's a set subtraction problem. You have to think of all the things you wanted to talk about and then minus all the things we actually talked about and then see whether there's a gap there. That's a difficult problem for people to contribute. Don't worry, you're not the first person to get stymied at that question. So I'm not going to complain at all.
Like book, yay, okay. Book is awesome. Please buy the book and give it to your friends and buy it for all your family for Christmas. Do try to buy it from the Pragmatic site rather than Amazon. Although if Amazon is how you roll, that's fine too. But when you buy it from the Pragmatic website, not only does Pragmatic get a larger cut because Amazon, you know, has to take their cut as well to remain a solvent company. I respect that. But it is DRM free if you go for the EPUB, the ebook. So as somebody who does deeply believe in the freedom of information, I am all for you going for the DRM free version rather than the Amazon version. Or get it in hard copy and find me at a conference. And I'm happy to, you know, sign it or do whatever else you do. I'm trying to get comfortable with that. So I'm going to say that and just offer it.
And if somebody picks up the movie rights, who's going to play you?
Oh. I don't know. Who's some sort of foul-mouthed woman in Hollywood right now? She'll probably play
That's
me.
That's all of them, isn't it? No, never mind. I hope so.
I hope so. They should be.
Great. And then two questions I have to ask, and I think I know the answer to one of them, but we'll go ahead. What's your favorite programming language?
I actually don't program anymore. And since I kind of table flipped my way out of Perl, I don't know that I can officially say Perl anymore. But it was Perl when I did program. I do love Perl. Yes. I think it's a very good language that has a lot of great going for it. And people who don't like Perl haven't looked at modern Perl because it's just a great fucking language.
And what text editors did you use to write the book?
Vim. MacVim, no less.
MacVim?
MacVim, yes. I like a GUI, man. I do like me a GUI. But when I was writing on my iPad, I used it's so hard to say that. Textastic. Textastic editor on iPad Pro. Amazing. Working copy Git. It's a Git client. It is so good. And it has a really, really responsive developer who gets back to you if you have bugs. I mean, both of those apps, great responsive developers who just did great things for me throughout the writing of the book. I'm so grateful to them.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Vicky, it's been just a pleasure chatting with you. This has been great. Got a lot of good topics covered today. And I know people have been clamoring for like the generic open source, show instead of it always being about projects. So I'm glad, we snuck a project into your book, but I'm glad that we got a lot of this real important general information out there. And I look forward to seeing you at both All Things Open and at Siegel. So I'll be at Siegel as well. So I'll see you twice.
Awesome. Excellent.
Twice in the next 3 months or so. Yes, 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 yes. We can have a microbrew up in Seattle where they're really good.
I'm trying to quit drinking, but I can sit around and drink a microbrew.
Okay, all right. We can work on that. Vicky, thank you for being on the show.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, guys, both of you.
Yep. Okay. That was Vicky Brasseur talking about all things relevant to open source communities, community building. Things that are important to keep in mind as you're expanding. We didn't get to all the questions in the chat room. I'm so sorry about that, but it was just a busy show, and we're actually running a little over right now. Gareth, what do you think?
I thought that was a great show. I thought it was like a perfect topic for the 500th show. It's like I said at the start, it's a very a timely topic to be talking about, given the state of a lot of communities. And I hope everyone, not just because Vicky is my friend, but I hope everyone goes and buys her book and learns something from it. And hopefully it is able to improve the communities that we all rely on and that we all love. It's a really good conversation.
Well, I'm actually going to break stride here because this will be I'm going to buy the hard copy of the book so I can get her autograph on it, and it'll be my first non-Kindle book that I've bought in years. So this was really cool. So I'm glad to do that. Well, I have Safari online, so I don't really need to have hard copies of almost all the books that I really need to access all the time anyway. But I'm definitely going to buy this hard copy and take it home with me in my suitcase. It's so cool. By the way, I'm actually in the middle of a 4-week trip, which the third week or the last week of which is actually being at ATO. So it's like I'm living out of a suitcase for 4 weeks in a row again. That's just the way it works. All right, I've taken up enough time. Let me talk about the upcoming guests so we can get out of here. Sway is next week. Sway is the Tiling Wayland compositor and drop-in replacement for the i3 window manager for X11, of which I know nothing of what that means. So hopefully somebody next week is going to be a Linux person that understands X11 and things so that I won't have to be totally embarrassed by what I don't know. Open Rhein-Ruhr after that, which is the German open source 2-day conference in early November. For those of you who've been hungering for another blockchain show, Monero is after that. Cryptocurrency, but private, untraceable, unfungible. Tidelift is after that. It gives maintainers and core teams a way to get paid for doing the work they love. So that should be interesting. Just added to the schedule last week, but still on the schedule this week, thank God, is Invoice Ninja, a powerful suite of online tools. So you can invoice clients, collect payments, create proposals, expenses, time tasks, and more. And they also have a fully open source from top to bottom. This is not a core model. This is just totally open source. They make their money on consulting and hosting, but you can host it yourself if you want, and it's totally free when you do that. And Great setup for that. That's going to be really cool. Also, they have an open source Flutter app, and they actually came to me because they have Flutter, and they know I've been talking about that, so I'm really excited about that as well. Go to twitch.tv/floss, the homepage for this show, if you want to see who else is coming up, at least the people we're talking to. I have two or three people on the short list, and they're trying to come up with dates and work it out with their co-guests, things like that, but we're working real close, trying to get everything else filled out all the way out to end of Q4. If you have any other suggestions, again, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me, merlin@stoneage.com. We did a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. Yay, back to Wednesday after a couple of mistaken shows there. Live to twit.tv. We took a number of questions from there. Always appreciate people giving us questions so that we can get stuff that's apropos to our audience. Follow me on Floss Weekly. Follow us on Floss Weekly and on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. Follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I'll probably also start doing more Medium posts as well. Medium, it seems like a really great blogging platform. So I'm going to do some more stuff over there. Again, I'm going to be at All Things Open in just, 2 weeks? 2 weeks, yeah, just 2 weeks. In what's left of Raleigh. Actually, I've been told no damage at all in Raleigh. No damage at all. So it's not, I was expecting, it's North Carolina. It's going to be trouble from Florence. But no, I'm going to be able to press and speaker. I'll be at Siegel in November up in Seattle as press. I'll be in KubeCon. In KubeCon. No, I did that joke last week. Okay. KubeCon in December, also in Seattle, as press once again, trying to look for more people to be on this show. Any short plugs, Gareth?
No, I'll just say I will also be at Siegel. I'll actually be speaking. So I'm not sure if you or Vicky mentioned the dates for that one, but it's actually November 9th and 10th up in Seattle. So
yeah,
looking forward to that. Should be good.
Yeah, but because actually I need to be in San Francisco like the day after that, I'm actually flying from here to Seattle. Not here, flying from Portland to Seattle. I was going to drive up, but I'm going to fly from Portland to Seattle and from Seattle to San Francisco, then San Francisco to L.A., and then L.A. to – where's the next one? There's one other thing. Anyway, I got a crazy schedule for coming up for that, so it's just going to be crazy. Anyway, good deal. Gareth. Thanks for coming back on the show. I appreciate that. And when your name popped up, I was like, oh my God, Gareth wants to be on the show. That's cool. And definitely appropriate questions. And thank you for your contributions today.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It was a good time. I'm glad I got to be the co-host for the 500th show.
500 show. 500! Half a thousand. Half a thousand, halfway to 1,000. Let's see if I'm still. Okay, let's talk about open source. I remember when I was a kid, we didn't have open source. You paid for your stuff. All right. All right. Hey, guys, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.